After Russ Feingold lost his re-election bid to Senator Ron Johnson in 2010, he put his work in the Foreign Relations Committee to work when Secretary of State John Kerry asked him to go to Africa.
Now a U.S. special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo, Feingold says his job is probably the most satisfying one he's ever had.
Our next guest caught up with him in Congo to talk about his diplomatic work in the region. Stuart Reed is a senior editor at Foreign Affairs magazine. He recently reported on his trip for Politico in a story called "Did Russ Feingold Just End a War?" Stuart, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, when he was a senator, Russ Feingold was mostly known for his work on campaign finance reform with Senator John McCain. And since his loss to Ron Johnson, we don't hear from him as much. We don't hear about him as much, at least here in Wisconsin. But it turns out he's been incredibly busy in Africa. Can you fill us in on what's been going on with him since he lost to Ron Johnson?
Sure. So after he lost in 2010, he went to Stanford Law School and wrote a book, and then in 2013, he got a call from John Kerry, his old buddy from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, asking him to become U.S. Special Envoy to the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Great Lakes region of Africa. And the main task for that position was to help end a long-running civil war in eastern Congo and handle the regional diplomacy and sort of elevate the conflict from the U.S. perspective above the individual ambassador level. So he took the position in July 2013 and then has been making lots of trips to the region and, as I argue, played a fairly significant role in helping bring at least some measure of peace to that region.
Well, and the thing is, unbeknownst to lots of people, Senator Feingold, or Russ Feingold, not a senator any longer, but he had amassed quite an expertise on Africa. How did that happen?
Right. So the way he tells it is when he won election in 1992, he joined the Senate in 93, he was told that as a junior senator from Wisconsin, he couldn't get the Judiciary Committee, couldn't get appropriations, but he could get foreign relations. But because he was so junior, he was only able to get the Africa subcommittee. And so someone told him that he'd be, quote, stuck on the Africa subcommittee. So he ended up on that committee and ended up running it within not that long and sort of became a respected authority on Africa issues within the Senate and traveled to the continent on many congressional delegations and sort of almost by accident sort of became an expert on Africa.
Well, and as it turns out, the work has suited him well. He's told you that he finds it much more satisfying than his work in the U.S. Senate. Why is that?
Well, what he told me was in the Senate, there are a lot of maybes. So if you propose a bill, at first it has to get out of committee. You have to attract co-sponsors. It has to then get passed and then get not vetoed. So there are all these sort of steps, and there's a pretty big distance between, action and result. Whereas being a diplomat in Congo, he said there was much more immediacy. He was, walking, shuttling between government and rebel negotiators in this conflict and sort of making decisions on the fly and really, in the weeds and the diplomacy of it. And he just found that particularly satisfying. He also said that it was less politicized, that because Africa is, certainly not at the top of the U.S. foreign policy agenda, there was a lot of leeway, and it wasn't a politicized issue. There isn't a Republican position on Congo versus a Democratic position. That that lack of attention is actually helpful in a way.
Well, as you say, the struggle in the Democratic Republic of Congo, it hasn't been in the world's spotlights. Can you give us a brief history of the conflict going on there and what it's been unfolding?
So it traces back to 20 years ago, but to make a long story short, the eastern part of Congo has long been plagued by civil war, and various rebel groups have controlled territory and fought against the Congolese government. So in April 2012, the most recent group popped up. It was called the M23, and this is a group of rebels that wanted to overthrow the Congolese government, and they were actually backed by Congo's neighbor, Rwanda. So they were secretly receiving training and equipment and support from Rwanda, going across the border into Congo and attacking the military and taking over territory. So in April 2012, they started up, and things sort of got worse by the end of that year, and it became an international embarrassment because Congo has been home to the world's largest UN peacekeeping mission. And it was sort of an embarrassment that this rebel group could take so much territory right under the UN's nose. And so as I detail in my article, what ended up happening was the United States shifted its position towards Rwanda, Rwanda being the country that had been backing these rebels, and started putting more pressure on Rwanda, which had traditionally been a U.S. ally. Feingold comes in the summer of 2013, and they end up upping the pressure to the point that the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, ends up pulling support for this rebel group operating inside the neighboring Congo. And that group, the M23, ends up collapsing and sort of getting defeated within days.
And this was a complicated thing because the United States, it took a long time to get a cohesive position on how the United States was going to deal with Rwanda and Paul Kagame, because we had some interest in upholding him as a president of moral value and someone who was getting a lot of good work done. What happened to shift that position?
Sure. So there, as you say, there's sort of two sides to Paul Kagame, the president of Rwanda. On the one hand, he's been incredibly effective at using aid money, and you know, his record on public health, on fighting corruption, all sorts of running a government things has been extraordinarily good, and his military is famously competent. However, on the other side of the coin, he's been secretly backing this rebel group called the M23, and also his country is not a bastion of democracy. It's a place where political dissidents get harassed and elections get stolen. So there was this sort of two sides of Kagame, and for a long time, the United States decided to ignore the dark side and basically support him as the best alternative there. But what ended up happening in late 2012 and over the course of 2013 was that the U.S. decided enough is enough and sort of pressured Kagame to knock it off.
And looking at Russ Feingold's role in all of this, you know, he had been a U.S. senator, and there's a lot of backroom wheedling that goes on in the Senate and in Congress in general. But as someone who functions more like a diplomat, it seems like you'd be looking more at qualities like subtlety and persuasion. So how did he make the jump to that sort of skill set?
Sure. So, I mean, as he puts it, in a lot of ways it's not so different, because there is a lot of persuasion that goes on in the Senate, and there is a lot of diplomacy and sort of, you know, creating coalitions and talking different sides. So I think he would, I can't speak for him obviously, but I think he would say that there's less difference than you might think. And he also said that he loves seeing the politicians in Congo because they remind him of himself, and he sort of sees his own behavior. And I think that was clear on the trip that, you know, when he knows how to work a room, and has, you know, there were times when he'd be meeting with a group of local religious officials, and sort of you could picture him back in Wisconsin meeting with, you know, the firefighters union or whatever. There were a lot of parallels like that. So I think it's in a way it's not so different.
And so the title of your piece is, did Russ Feingold just end a war? What's the answer to that question?
Well, I think the answer is it's too soon to say, because, I mean, first of all, this was, as Senator Feingold himself would admit, you know, an effort on the part of the U.S. government to change its position. It wasn't just him alone. And also there were other things that led to the collapse of this rebel group. The Congolese military sort of got actually better at fighting. So did the UN peacekeeping mission. So it wasn't just Russ Feingold. And it's also important to point out that even though this major rebel group has become a thing of the past, Eastern Congo is still not completely out of the woods yet. There are still other rebel groups. There still is the chance that, you know, a new one could pop up. That said, for the average person living in Eastern Congo, life has gotten significantly better since this group collapsed. So it's complicated. And as I make clear in the piece, one of the big challenges that still remains is getting the Congolese government to start acting like a government and gaining control of its territory.
We're talking right now with Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, about Russ Feingold's new career as special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're talking with Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, about Russ Feingold's work as a U.S. diplomat in Africa's Great Lakes region and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Stuart is the author of a recent article in Politico magazine. It was called, "Did Russ Feingold Just End a War?"
And you can join the conversation. As our guest mentioned, Africa is sometimes an afterthought in American foreign policy, in the media. Do you think that's a mistake? Should Africa be more front and center in our minds, in our foreign policy, in our media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
And Stuart, in Davos recently, the work that had been happening in Congo got a shout out. I think it was from Kerry. They were talking about how, look, this is what we can accomplish sometimes when the spotlight isn't on and people are working conscientiously behind the scenes and it's not so pressurized. Is that something that you think Russ Feingold does deserve credit for, that he did accomplish quite a lot, even if you can't lay everything that happened at his doorstep? What does he deserve credit for?
Yeah, I mean, I think more broadly here, what the diplomatic effort of the U.S. government in Eastern Congo shows, I believe, is that you can accomplish quite a bit without you know, sending military contingents over there. This was a pretty cheap effort on the part of the U.S. government, right? They sent Russ Feingold there. They sort of withheld some aid, made some phone calls, and increased pressure on Rwanda, and it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference in getting this rebel group to lay down its arms. So I think what John Kerry would say and what Russ Feingold would say is, yeah, that U.S. power can still work. I mean, especially if you think of how hard it is to get what America wants in places like Ukraine or Syria, here's an example of American power actually accomplishing something. Will it last forever? Who knows? Was it entirely the result of U.S. power? No. But I think you could make a case that it did make a difference here.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got James joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, James.
Hi. Yes, I think it's a good thing that Russ is over there. The United States does need to focus more on what's going on in Africa in light of the fact that right now we're experiencing a scramble for African resources. China is all the way in there now, and the U.S. has to have some kind of a goodwill or develop a goodwill like it did it back in the 60s with the Peace Corps if they do want to have an influence on what's going to happen in the next 10 to 20 years.
Okay, interesting perspective. Thanks a lot, James. And what about Russ doing just that, spreading U.S. goodwill and involvement and demonstrating commitment to Africa?
Yeah, I mean, the caller pointed out China, and I think that's an interesting comparison, that one of the stories, a big story of Africa over the past decade or so has been the rise of Chinese involvement. And you see this in the Congo. You see the hotel we stayed in Kinshasa, the capital, was built by the Chinese in 2011 and had Chinese restaurant in it. So the influence is definitely there. And I think that may be one small motivating factor for or an argument you can make of why the U.S. should pay more attention to Africa, that because China is. And the way the two countries act is very different. I mean, the United States is sort of explicitly promoting democracy in China, or excuse me, democracy in Africa, whereas China is focused more, as the caller said, on resources.
Now, aside from the peace agreement he helped to broker between the M23 and the Congolese government, There are other pressing issues that are happening in Congo, including conservation issues. You went with him on a trek to see gorillas, and their numbers have plummeted from something like 17,000 to 5,000 over this period of civil unrest. It's also the rape capital of the world, apparently. How involved is Russ Feingold in issues like those?
I mean, I think what he would say is that they're all they all can be blamed on the same thing, which is the conflict itself, and that if you solve the conflict, then you will see improvements in the safety of women, you'll see improvements in environmental issues. And you know, while the guerrilla trek was sort of the day off there, it wasn't you know, explicitly part of the diplomatic effort, I think, you know, there is an argument to be made that Eastern Congo has huge tourism potential. However, I think we're, you know, many, many years or decades at least away from that. And he did also visit a hospital that specializes in treating the survivors of rape. So he sees this as sort of, you know, there are many different facets to this crisis, and he's going to try and be involved in as many as possible.
Now, you mentioned that sometimes when you can see him in Africa at work, you can just picture him back in Wisconsin doing his thing, being a consummate politician here, as he was for several years. And I wonder, because sometimes there's a sense in Wisconsin among, I suppose, especially Democrats, you know, where is Russ Feingold? He never calls. He never writes.
I found him.
Where is he? You know, and I wonder if he indicated to you whether Wisconsin's on his mind and he's intending to reengage himself in Wisconsin politics at any point.
Yeah, well, he never would, you know, reveal his future plans of that. And he did say that usually for these special envoy jobs, you end up staying, you know, around 2 or 3 years. And he started in July 2013. So I have no special insight into whether he'll, you know, run for Senate again, which has been floated as an idea, or whether he'll be a vice presidential pick. I have no idea. But, you know, he did talk frequently about Wisconsin and make comparisons. You know, for instance, he talked about reintroducing elk in Wisconsin, how that had been a project that one could look to for inspiration of how to reintroduce gorillas into Congo.
You get the sense, I don't know, you don't say this explicitly in your article, but you do get the sense that he was happy to kind of shake off some of the dust of the partisan rancor in Washington and just kind of take a break and take a completely different track, but do work that he seems to think is just as meaningful, if not more meaningful.
Sure. I mean, I think he was particularly frustrated near the end of his career in the Senate by the Tea Party. He explained to me that, you know, he liked to hold town meetings in each of Wisconsin's counties. And what ended up happening near the end of his time in office was that they sort of got hijacked by the Tea Party and they would come and disrupt it. So I think he was a little, you know, relieved in a way to leave all the partisanship behind. And I'm sure he, in 2010, would have preferred to have won. But, yeah, as he said to me, this is one of his most favorite things that he's done in his life.
So he didn't reveal the future to you, what his intentions are, but could you see him pursuing a diplomatic track instead of entering the political fray again?
I don't know. I mean, I think this is sort of a one-off diplomatic posting that takes advantage of his sort of stature, his interest in Africa, and I'm not sure there are, you know, what other positions within the diplomatic world he could take on. I don't know. It's sort of anyone's guess. At least I don't have any special insight into that, I'd say.
Now, when he was a senator, Russ Feingold tried to warn the U.S. that parts of Africa were a safe haven for al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. Is that something that's still on his mind? Is it something he's trying to beat the drum about to this day?
Yeah, I mean, he's long had the argument that the United States should be paying more attention to Africa. In the case of Congo, you can't make the argument that this helps the fight against al-Qaeda. They're just not there, and there isn't really much of an Islamist presence, although in the north there are some groups. But yeah, I think he's still making the case that Africa should be higher up on the agenda than it currently is. And I think part of the reason he's making that case is he's saying, look, you can actually achieve a lot here. You know, this is the developing world, most of it, and the U.S. has influence and can be sort of a positive force here in a way that it's probably trickier to in other places.
Now, if I recall correctly, he's 61 years old?
Yes.
I don't know how that augurs for a continued political career at that age. Is it something you see as this is something he's taken on, and from here he moves on to other august but less political posts, or is 61 still your prime when you're a politician?
Well, I mean, he was putting in 12-hour days and said that, you know, it was a little harder than when he was 40 years old, but it was still, I was, you know, I was exhausted at the end of the day just sitting there taking notes. So I can't imagine how tiring it must have been to actually be, you know, the center of attention and working a room and speaking. You know, he seemed in good health and lively, and I'm not sure that 61's that old for a politician.
Did you tell him lots of folks in Wisconsin were thinking about him?
I think he gets that sense, although he did say that when he took the job to be special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa, someone in Wisconsin asked him, "Oh, does that mean you're going to be out in Lake Erie measuring water levels with a stick?" So he had to sort of explain his role, that there's another Great Lakes, to some Wisconsinites.
Did you get the sense that he wanted to do more in this vein as he got through this position in Africa that you say could last a couple, 2 to 3 years? Were these accomplishments enough, do you think, to keep him moving in that direction?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, these roles as special envoy, the idea is that, you know, relations will return to a normal point where the United States won't need to have a special envoy, and it can just treat it like any other, you know, healthy region where there are ambassadors. However, that probably won't be the case anytime soon. I mean, there's still a lot of challenges that remain in the region, but I think he's, you know, I can't speak for him, but it would surprise me if he suddenly lost interest in Africa.
Stuart, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this today.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Stuart Reed, senior editor at Foreign Affairs Magazine, talking about Russ Feingold's diplomatic work as a special envoy to Africa.